You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good morning. On behalf of the Brookings China Center, I'm pleased to welcome you all to this very special event addressing youth, a stage of life I wish I had more personal experience with. Well, arguably, no demographic group in the history of the world has witnessed a greater economic and social transformation than today's Chinese youth, who have grown up parallel to China's emergence as a global economic power. During their formative years, today's Chinese youth have seen roads fit by bicycles, replaced by highways, filled with Audis and BMWs, even in second-tier cities in China. They have seen the blue skies of their younger days stand by a dusty haze. And they have been obsessed with the networking of Weibo and WeChat. Now, this unique demographic group has witnessed the power of social economic transformation, both for better and worse. And as the title of today's event suggests, youth are also transforming Chinese society in many tangible ways. They will build on dramatic changes that they have witnessed in their lifetime as they emerge as leaders of all walks of life that will shape China for years and decades to come. Now, today we are so lucky to have the opportunity to learn more about the Chinese youth from a delegation from Chinese Academy of Social Sciences led by Director Chen Guangjing and my good friend Li Chunling. They have come all the way from Beijing to discuss with us their new groundbreaking sociological research on this important yet under-researched demographic group. What is most impressive about this CAS research team is that many of them are also young scholars, very young, in their middle 20s and probably even younger than that. How could you have such kind of distinguished younger scholars, you know? And many of them already have their PhDs. Even at their young age, they have already made a remarkable impact in the field of sociology. Now, this also reminds me that according to several survey research in the United States about the American public opinion regarding China, the research by peer research and also by Committee of 100 I heavily involved, have the similar finding that the younger age group in the United States, namely later teenagers and up to 29 years old, they usually have more favorable views of China. The points actually is almost 20 points higher than preceding groups. So I really want to know, I don't know whether in your research also cover this kind of attitudinal things about the United States, and if so, whether Chinese younger generation have the better views about the United States or not. I'm very curious. I don't know whether, I know that your main topic is not about that, but it will be fascinating if you can share, if you have the data on that topic. So they're not all countries, I mean, young people have the better views than the preceding generation about China, but in the United States, we find a pattern over the past decade that the younger group have more favorable views of China. This is very encouraging. Now, I'm also thankful to have with us several well-known China scholars from universities in the United States. I'm particularly pleased that we have the honor of hearing from my good friend, Marty White from Harvard, who will be keynoting this event. As an authority on sociology studies in China, and really an intellectual giant in this field, Marty has conducted some landmark survey research on Chinese youth of his own. We feature him many times here at Brookings, and most recently about our book launch on middle class, and we're so pleased to have you then, and also pleased to have you back to Brookings. I also want to thank my Chinese China Center colleague, Jonathan Pollock, a good friend, of course, for moderating the keynote session, especially in such short notice, in replacing Ken Libersole, who cannot be here this morning. He sent his best to the team, to the delegation, and to particularly his longtime friend, Marty White. We're also very happy to be joined by two scholars who are making their Brookings debut as they moderate our two panels today. First, we have Dr. Guo Yong, a visiting scholar at Harvard, an associate professor at the Tsinghua University. He actually also was in charge of student affairs at the Tsinghua University for many years. Tough job, right? And he will moderate our first panel on youth mobility and lead a discussion on education, employment, and inequality. And second, we have Dr. Marcel. The last name, it's really, I cannot pronounce at all. I know that, let me try. Shablevitz. Thank you. Whose name I really cannot pronounce, never can pronounce, but whose scholarship is truly outstanding. Anyone who has read her articles will agree with me. It's fascinating research. And also, I know that you are working on your new book. I think that it will soon be a best-selling book. Your name will become, you know, widely known in China. I think you probably should have Chinese translation of your name. It's really fascinating. Well, he is an assistant professor at the Pace University in New York, and she will lead a panel on how Chinese youth are adapting to a commercialized digital era. And thank you all for our speakers and the panelists for joining us today. I know that we are all excited to hear your insightful findings and commentary. But before doing so, let me turn to my co-host of the conference, a distinguished scholar by himself, Chen Guangjing, Director of Institute of Sociology at CAS, to offer his opening remarks. Dr. Chen.
Good morning, everybody, ladies and gentlemen. And I'm very pleased to be here. First of all, I should say something on the behalf of Dr. Li Peiling, the Vice President of Chinese Academy of Social Sciences, abbreviated as CAS. I would like to thank Dr. Jonathan Pollack for sparing your valuable time to attend this workshop. And I am also grateful to Dr. Li Chen for organizing this fabulous workshop for my delegation. And again, congratulations for your recent appointment. Moreover, it will be great honor and pleasure to hear speech and comments from Professor Martin White, Professor Guo Yong, and Professor Marcel Stepowitz. Plus, my colleagues can survive from your comments and criticism. And this delegation, me and the other 8 members, came from the Institute of Sociology of CAS. This time, we bring the team of the panel survey of Chinese colleague students and graduates. Colleague students are an important part of Chinese youth. Not only are they the important force to shape the future of China society, but also their pressures and desires are becoming thorny issues today. And this team, headed by Professor Li Chunlin, he is conducting an ongoing 5-year survey based on colleague students and fresh graduates in 12 universities and colleges in China. Among them, not only including the elite universities, but also common universities and junior colleges as well. This survey, taken through an online systems, aims to collect information on various aspects of those youth including life goals, consumptions, internet behaviors, cultural preferences, school to employment transition, political attitudes, and so on. So you will hear their presentations on the first wave of data analysis thon. Hope you will enjoy it. And I know you guys are tired of campaigning for my institute, but before handing over my microphone to Professor Martin White, I would like to send all of you a message of invitation to approach us for further cooperation. Besides of hosting your visiting fellowship, we can together conduct surveys, co-author articles, organize conferences, release reports, and even build a joint center or program, as we have been engaging with many other strategic cooperators from the globe. And particularly, I wish this visit could blossom the relationship between my institute and John Thornton China Center on the leadership for Dr. Li Chen, and hope cooperation between our two think tanks can be productive and constructive. Thank you very much.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you to my colleague, Cheng Li, and to Professor Chen as well for your very, very appropriate introductory remarks. I'm delighted to be here. I'm substituting for Ken Lieberthal, who, as Cheng has mentioned, sends his best and is here in spirit. We are really privileged this morning to initiate this event by hearing from Marty White from Harvard University. I should say parenthetically, I first encountered Marty a long time ago when I was a graduate student at the University of Michigan. Marty, I won't disclose the precise number of years. Well, actually, I know. Well, we both know roughly how long it was. To me, Marty always looks so unchanging, but that's okay. That's okay. Of course, a few people have influenced the field of the study of China at a sociological level than Marty has, that we are all very, very familiar with it. What I think he'll try to do this morning, and he should speak for himself, of course, is to set some of our discussion in a both a larger context, and I think in some ways remind us of some of the difficulties of generalization when you begin to disaggregate some of the trends that we see in China. On that basis, Marty, welcome back to Brookings. We're delighted to have you here, and all of us look forward to your remarks.
Thank you.
This is a podium where you have to be very careful when you step out of your chair. You may disappear.
Thank you very much. It's very nice to be back at Brookings. And as a sociologist who studies China, I'm very eager to hear what our Chinese colleagues have to say about their research and their latest research on Chinese youth. I'm also, of course, a little intimidated, partly because whenever I get these kind of introductions, it sets a very high bar that I don't think I can meet. And also, my own research is on slightly different topics today rather than on specifically on Chinese youth, so I'm not necessarily up to date on all the things we'll learn today. But I thought I would, as Jonathan mentioned, talk about some concerns I have just about the profile of Chinese youth and how difficult it is to generalize. And my comments you might call my remarks a tale of two youths, with apologies to Charles Dickens. And what I mean here is the situation of rural origin youths versus urban origin youths, it seems to me, has in recent times been quite divergent, and in some ways is diverging even more widely. And so there's a difficulty, it seems to me, in a challenge to our Chinese colleagues and to other researchers trying to generalize in sort of two parts of a large group that are in some ways going in different directions. Let me start by making a few familiar comments about the demography of China and the demography of Chinese youth. We all know that China has been urbanizing rapidly in recent years. We're told that early in this decade, China crossed the divide to become 50% urban. So maybe China is 55% urban in terms of population now. But that 55% includes both people with urban hukou, people who I will call urban citizens, but it also includes more than 200 million migrants and sometimes their children. if you consider China's population not in terms of whether they're in rural or urban areas, but by essentially their citizenship status, agricultural hukou citizens, including both rural people and migrants, still constitute the large majority of the population, maybe close to 65%. And for Chinese youth, it's probably even larger because, of course, fertility is higher in the countryside than it is in the cities. The cities have the one-child policy very strictly enforced, but it's more commonly in the countryside, two children. So we also know that the Chinese government has recently announced last month new plans to have a new set of policies about urbanization to both increase urbanization further, but also they are pledging to eliminate eventually this distinction between your hukou status, whether you're a rural citizen or an urban citizen, because essentially up to now during rural citizens have been discriminated against and deprived of lots of urban opportunities and privileges, and there have been experiments to try to change this and soften this, but still it's very much in place. So down the road, I'm hopeful that these new policies will make a difference, but I'm also skeptical because there have been many promises before to overcome the discrimination against people of rural origin in China. But they haven't been very successful. It's important to note, many of you may be familiar, just in terms of one indicator, the income gap between urban citizens and rural citizens, China is perhaps the most unequal country on the entire planet. In 2007, the latest CHIP survey that's been published indicated that urban hukou people compared to rural people, the family income gap was about 4-1. This is really extraordinarily high. So all of this means that there have been wide differences in the life situations and opportunities of rural citizens versus urban citizens in China. Again, rural citizens, I mean both people living in the countryside and also migrants who came from the countryside. And so I'm wondering how easy it is to talk about Chinese youth without taking into account this huge divide. So let me start by talking about my impressions of the situation in recent times for rural citizen youths. Still about, as I say, at least two-thirds of all youth have rural citizenship in these terms. First, as I've already indicated, they're more likely than their urban counterparts to have a sibling. They're not so likely to be an only child. They're also, as I've already indicated from talking about the income gap, they're much more likely to grow up in severe poverty. China's made dramatic progress against poverty, but nonetheless, it's still much more common in the countryside, much deeper. they're also less exposed to the highly commercialized and internet-savvy daily lives of people in the cities. This is closing somewhat the internet gap. Is closing. Rural people are becoming more connected, and rural youths particularly, and even more so migrant youths. But nonetheless, it's still a higher proportion of people with rural origins that are not totally immersed in the sort of highly commercialized and sort of pop culture, all of the internet things. So the digital divide may be narrowing, but that it hasn't closed much. They also face very rural origin youths face very difficult options in trying to figure out how to get ahead in life. Do they remain in farming? Not too many seem to want to do that these days. Do they try to find a non-farming job in the local area, working in a, what the current version of the TVEs or other kinds of non-agricultural activities. Do they try to get ahead via education? Maybe even aiming to get into college and get a white-collar job and so forth. That's difficult to do, and I'll talk about that in a moment. Or do they become a migrant laborer, going off into towns and cities looking for better opportunities? All of these face sort of difficult challenges and obstacles. Getting ahead via education in particular is extraordinarily difficult if you're of rural origins. Okay. First, of course, rural schools themselves, if these kids stay in the countryside, are poorer quality. Many of the rural, the ones who are staying in the countryside, if they have migrant parents, may be having just grandparents at home to help supervise their school activities. Even their parents will have less sort of educational background, cultural capital than urban parents tend to have. If the kids go into the city with the parents, then they face dilemmas about whether they get, what kind of school they can get into and how much it will cost. They're, mostly up to now, migrant kids have had to attend private schools of uncertain quality and sometimes subject to being closed down. In the past, they've had to pay very high fees if they wanted to get into urban public schools. That is supposed to be changing, but even if they get into urban public schools, they're often segregated in, so they're not treated the same as urban origin kids. And my understanding is in most localities, even if they get into the urban public schools, they can't go beyond lower middle school graduation, which is the end of compulsory schooling in China. And then if they want to go to upper middle school or high school, they have to go back to their rural village, and they can't take the Gaokao, the college examination in the city, but they have to do it back in their countryside. So, and if they stay in the countryside or go back to the countryside, by lower middle school and upper middle school, they often have to go into boarding schools because most villages don't have nearby high schools, middle schools that they can attend. So again, it's an expensive proposition, a difficult thing. And partly as a result of all of this, China has experienced, as you all know, a huge expansion of college enrollments since the late 1990s. China today has something close to 10 times as many college students as it had in the mid-1990s. So one would think this is a huge thing that opens up a huge amount of opportunity. But in fact, the disproportionate, overwhelming amount of those places are going to urban citizen kids. Okay. It's still very hard. Relatively few rural kids get all the way through Gaojunbie, take the Gaokao, get into college, and so forth. So it's despite this expansion, it's almost all the advantages going to the people in the cities. So they're largely the most common result for a child born in the countryside is. That they will be a lower middle school graduate, and they will have to look for jobs as laborers and service sector jobs and so forth. So there's a limit to how far ahead that they're likely to get. So a huge amount of potential talent in China is, from my point of view, being wasted because of the obstacles that make it so difficult for rural kids to get ahead, so much more difficult than for urban kids. But there are at least a couple of slightly positive signs of this. That with the sort of changing of the Chinese economy, the wages of unskilled, semi-skilled laborers and so forth have been going up, and the chances of being unemployed totally are relatively lower than they are for some more educated groups. And rural and migrant youths also don't face the kind of very high expectations and obstacles in terms of, you know, having to have your own a stable job, an apartment, a car in order to be able to get married and so forth. So the obstacles in some things are a little easier in the countryside because the expectations are lower. On the urban side of things, from what I've said, it's obvious that urban kids are more overwhelmingly likely to be the only child. They're also more likely than rural kids the opposite of what I said before, to have well-educated parents with high aspirations for them, and parents and grandparents and extended kin all sort of placing expectations and hope on them. My Harvard colleague Vanessa Fong wrote a book called Only Hope, based upon interviews in urban families in Dalian, and the sort of extraordinary expectations and so forth. In America, upper-middle-class families increasingly know what this is like. There's a sociologist named Annette Leroux that talks about concerted cultivation. I actually have two families. I was married and raised kids in an earlier era, and then my wife and I actually have a Chinese daughter who's now in college. And my second family, the expectations, you know, and what parents are supposed to do, you know, you have to have violin lessons and soccer camps and, you know, computer school and all these kind of things. Well, Chinese urban parents, especially in the middle class, obviously, are increasingly feeling they have to invest all of this in their children. And it's very different from what happens to the, generally speaking, to rural kids, rural citizen kids. Obviously, urban youth are more likely to have pocket money, resources, ability to spend on their own, access to digital devices, broad exposure to the, you know, highly commercialized society in which they now live and so forth. Sort of migrants are in the middle here. Migrant youths in the city are partly exposed to all of these things, but much more so than rural kids who stay in the countryside. The path to get ahead via education seems much easier in urban society now. It is probably the case that if you're an urban kid in China, it's easier to get into a college than it is for an American child. Well over 50% of urban youths can get into college in China now. Because of this huge expansion, okay? There's still extremely hectic competition to prepare for the Gaokao because it makes much more difference now which college you get into and what you're studying and so forth. So with this huge expansion, the people that get into the best colleges and can graduate and hope to get good paying jobs in, you know, the domestic companies, foreign companies, government jobs and so forth. But at the bottom of the new education, higher educational ladder, you have very high unemployment. You have the Yizhou phenomena, the Amp tribe, you know, young people with college degrees from second and third tier colleges who can't find a job. One recent Chinese survey, not by the CAS group, but somebody else, claimed that young people in their early 20s, if they had a college degree, they had 16% unemployment. Only lower middle school graduates had only an 8% unemployment, so twice as much unemployment. So this phenomenon of educated unemployed, which occurs in some other developing societies as well, is increasingly becoming a problem in China. And that, of course, puts the parental and grandparental pressure of not only getting into a good school but getting a good job, but then being able to afterwards demonstrate the lifestyle through an apartment and your own car and so forth so that you can get married, sort of a huge amount of pressure. And there's also the increasing phenomenon of the growing equalization of college between genders means there are more and more highly educated women. And for them, there's this added problem, the left-behind women problem, that many Chinese men still don't seem to want to marry women that are as educated or more educated than they are. So worries about women, again, an important part of the talent pool who are getting a high degree of schooling, but is that harming their chances of having somebody to marry them? So all of this means to me that there are distinctive kinds of life experiences and problems and opportunity structures for rural youths, rural origin youths, including both rural youths and migrant youths, versus urban youths. And I'm wondering, in the research of our Chinese colleagues, how they're able to bridge this gap. And I'm particularly hopeful that in either their present or their future research, they can make sure that they don't direct all of their attention to the favored urban youth side of the equation, which, as I've indicated, is only a little more than a third of total youths. Two-thirds of the youths are still on the other side of the rural-urban divide, which hasn't yet closed. And finally, my other hope, my more distant and larger hope, is that somehow, finally, Chinese leaders will find a way to eliminate this distinction based upon your hukou status and so forth, which is one of the real ironies of reform-era China. This is a legacy of Chinese socialism in the 1950s. This was a way for Mao Zedong and his colleagues to keep him down on the farm. Everything, so many other things about the economy have been reformed, but still the idea that if you're born in the countryside, you have for the rest of your life a different and lower set of opportunities and more discrimination. That's still with Chinese youth today. It's with Chinese adults as well. And I hope finally this very unjust system of discrimination between rural and urban people can somehow be eliminated, but it's going to be a very difficult job. Thank you.
Marty, thank you very, very much for this very enlightening and also very sobering picture. You know, we here at Brookings often deal with the debate in Washington about China, which is often at the 30,000-foot level, but we are deeply committed to having, if you will, an on-the-ground understanding of China, and we've certainly gotten that this morning. I'm struck so much by the tenor of Marty's remarks in that it highlights yet again that the preoccupations of Chinese leaders will be, if you will, broadly the domestic circumstances that they confront, or if it isn't their preoccupation, it should be. I'm just simply struck by the daunting nature of what you're describing, how you get from here to there. There are very grand objectives, as you've highlighted, but a lot of these trends point to further stratification. Unless there is some kind of a means by which this remarkable gap can be bridged in the coming years, and that's obviously going to be an issue, I think, that we'll come back to over the course of this morning's discussion. In any event, I really appreciate Marty setting an overall tone for the discussion that is to come. This is a society that is undergoing some extraordinary stress, and we feel this palpably from what you have presented here today. So our thanks for shedding light on these phenomena in a major way. I'm going to open up the floor to questions now. I'm much more interested, we all are, rather than hearing us talk, but hearing from you about questions you might have in light of Marty's presentation or any other issues that you want to raise. So if you have a question, please raise your hand. We have a microphone that will circulate, and please do identify yourself, and we can proceed from there. Yes, I see a hand right there. Please.
I think I've never heard before an explanation that China has benefited by having too many men who can't get married, so they work very hard and they contribute more to the economy. That's a novel argument. I would say that the problem is that's a separate issue. It's another challenge China faces. The one-child policy
in my view, never should have been implemented in the first place, was a disaster in many ways. China was already successfully controlling its fertility before the one-child policy was announced and never could have continued a two-child policy without such disastrous results. And again, the leaders are beginning to slightly modify that policy, and I think they need to figure ways to do that as well as eliminate the hukou discrimination. But it seems to me it's a separate issue to the ones that I was raising.
Yes.
Hi, I'm Shouye Zhao. I'm a part-time intern here at the China Center. Dr. White, I have a question because I liked your book of the Myth of Social Volcano. I read it in my graduate school. And your book was mostly talking about how people were looking at social inequality, income inequality in China. And to me, my crude observation is that the thing in China is that people don't even have an opportunity to get ahead. And especially when you're talking about the second generation, the second rich generation. So I'm thinking your book was written in 2004, 2005. So 10 years later, do you think there's a new problem of upward social immobility instead of income inequality in the society that we should be focusing on? Thank you.
Okay. Well, that again brings in yet other issues. Rather than the ones I was raising in my talk today, but I would just say we've done a more recent survey, but only in 2009. Another survey is being planned, but hasn't been carried out yet. But I don't think that's the case overall. In other words, at least at the end of the last decade, in our survey in 2009, we found more people optimistic about their chances of improving their lives. But that's at the overall level. If you look at particular segments of the population, again, particularly for urban youths facing this sort of very high competition still to get into college and worries about unemployment and feeling that even if you have a college degree, you may be competing for jobs with migrant youths who have only lower middle school education. So for some segments of society, I think those feelings are very accurate. But I don't think it's true overall, but obviously if China's growth is slower now than it was in the past, then if it goes down further, that pretty much automatically translates into not quite so many opportunities. But believe me, in America, we would love to have 4% economic growth, 5%. You know, the idea of, you know, can you keep it up at 7.5%, or is it going to go down to 5%? I mean, any kind of substantial growth means basically more opportunities in the future. But nonetheless, not all groups see those opportunities and benefit from them equally, and there's very unequal opportunities that come from this growth.
Yes, I see a hand right there.
Yes, I'm Bert Wides, a pro bono attorney and recovering sociologist. And Professor White, your talk was really illuminatingly empirical. Professor Parsons would be proud.
He wasn't too empirical himself, by the way.
Actually, he was.
No, he was.
But my question relates to your comment that the rural youth now in the cities have to go to a private school or have a very hard time getting into public schools. And as you know, recently some of the leaders of the citizens movement protested that discrimination, and they and attorneys who came to their defense were beaten up in jail. And I'm wondering, is that discrimination because there's a lack of capacity in the schools, and it's sort of first come for the folks who were urban several generations? Is it discriminatory, and do you get any sense that the government is seeking to change that asymmetry?
Well, I must confess I'm stunned and about the logic or reasons behind it. I mean, the idea that a that now increasing numbers of cities are allowing migrant kids into the regular public schools without paying high fees. But then the idea that if they go through 9 years of schooling, they can't continue into upper middle school and they can't take the entrance exam there. I believe there are some localities in China that are experimenting with eliminating those rules, those restrictions. But for the most part, I think they're still in place. I'm a sociologist. I don't understand people in authority and why they make the decisions they make. But I will say that in the surveys that we've conducted, even urban people in very large majorities agree that denying entrance to schools because you have a nunya huko, or denying access to health or other benefits because you're from the countryside and so forth, that this is grossly unfair, but the people, the gatekeepers judging opportunities in the cities are very worried about having to provide housing, having to provide, having more youth. And also, I think in the schooling case, they're worried about rural kids who have less background and how they're, if they're put in the same schools with these urban kids who have these, concerted cultivation parents, that it's going to be a very unfair and unequal competition. So in some sense, there's a legacy of more than 50 years of discrimination here that's very difficult to get rid of. And we in American society, we have a different, racial history that poses some of the same problems and so forth. So it's no easy matter to just say, okay, now you can take the Gaokao in Shanghai instead of having to go back to your village. It doesn't solve... It's a huge number of interrelated things that would have to be changed in order to provide more equal opportunities for kids with rural origins.
Thank you. Yes, Chung has a question.
Thank you, Marty, for your really brilliant way to tell, a tale of two youths. And remind us the complexities involved and also, difficult to make generalization. And certainly that your sentiment about the inequality, discrimination, and many other problems are also widely shared among Chinese scholars in China. And I just got back from last night from Shanghai. People complain, particularly urban dwellers complain about they feel their privileges threatened by, new arrivals. Now, this reminds me that probably we should look at the current China situation in a broader historical perspective. How would you assess the entire reform era, particularly recent, a couple of decades? Do you think there's some kind of a positive development in terms of upward social mobility? Isn't it true that in terms of gender ratio in college, including graduate school, is unprecedentedly high with women students? And also, is that true that because the urban dwellers so much feel threatened, there's also a real movement going on in terms of social mobility? Is it possible when we look back in that period of China's development, China not only has this kind of what you point out, four times inequality between, urban and rural dwellers, but it's also true this is the fastest period in terms of social mobility when we look back. Is that possible?
Thank you. I didn't realize that my remarks were being interpreted as a condemnation of reform era and the desire to return to socialism of Mao Zedong.
I did not mean that.
Even the things that we're talking about, migrants and migrant youths face extraordinary discrimination and so forth. But one reason this is not a bigger social problem and political problem is because nonetheless, for a large part of the rural population born in rural areas, they're still much better off than they stayed in the countryside. And in the Mao era, they had to stay in the countryside. There was no floating population. You know, you couldn't migrate. You couldn't go to the city, find a job, and send your kids to private school or whatever. So the extraordinary, and you know, the people who go off and work in the cities, they're sending remittances back to the. So a large number of villages are being, you know, brought up, you know, from bitter poverty, partly by the earnings of the people who've left that Mao thought, you know, that leaving would be a brain drain and that it would drive the villages downward. Mao didn't understand economics too well, or he didn't understand Chinese history too well either, actually, in this regard, because the idea of talented people from grassroots countryside being given opportunities to rise higher is, you know, a basic bedrock of Chinese civilization through the dynasties, and Mao tried to, you know, totally invalidate that, which is very bizarre. So you know, I think China is infinitely better in most ways than it was in 1976, and it is not the case, even though China has stark inequalities, but it is not the case that the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. It's the poor are getting somewhat richer, and the rich are getting much, much richer. So the gaps are widening, but even the improvements in lives of people at the bottom have been quite spectacular. And the people we interview in 2004, more than 60% of the people we interviewed in that national survey said that their families were doing better or much better than 5 years earlier. In 2009, 75% said that they were doing better. Some people are losing out a little, but the majority, in America, there's no way that 60% of the people are saying they're doing better than they were 5 years earlier. Again, we would kill to have those kinds of indicators for our society. By the way, one other while I'm on the topic, which this is not related to youth or rural-urban gap, but the extraordinary rapid extension of medical insurance coverage in China in the last decade is really, you know, President Obama would kill for that. You know, in 2004, only 25% of the respondents in our survey had medical insurance. 5 years later, in 2009, 85% had medical insurance coverage. Now, admittedly, some of that coverage is very basic, minimal. It doesn't cover everything. People are still, you know, using bribes to get to better care and paying extra fees and so forth. But nonetheless, what wouldn't we give in America to be able to make that kind of progress in medical insurance coverage? So it's a very complicated mosaic.
Yeah. Marty has reminded us that one of the first questions we should always ask when we are drawing judgments about developments in a society, developments in an economy or whatever, is compared to what? And I guess my question, following up very much on what Chung asked and what you've presented, is it's really, can we characterize meaningfully the kind of the frame of reference that people have? You know, when they're asked this basic question about it's sort of the Ronald Reagan question, you know, are you better off than you were whatever number of years ago? Do you think that most people have a concept that is, if you will, more where we have come from and see how much better it is now? Or alternatively, do you see people who may be less certain about what the future could imply? I mean, I know it's hard to generalize about these things, but these are intimately related to people's expectations, what they impart to their children, and so forth. Is there anything that we can realistically say, or is it just too broad brush a question to pose?
Well, again, this again takes us to these broader issues rather than focusing on Chinese youth, but I'm glad to do so because everything about China is interesting and challenging. But in China and in every other society, how people feel about the fairness or unfairness of inequalities is not driven by the Gini coefficient or the economic growth rate or any other objectives statistic. It's driven by their relative expectations, their own past experiences, the impressions of people around them, people they know. They're driven much more by their local social environment than it is by So there can be huge corruption and cases off in the cities, but people don't, you know, that's not what drives people's attitudes. The same, the way I talk about it in the United States, I don't get too upset about how much money Bill Gates is making or Lady Gaga or, you know, Kobe Bryant or, you know, but if my colleague in my department gets a nicer office than I have, boy, I'm going to think something's very unfair at Harvard. So and in these respects, so these subjective impressions on how people are doing are driven by these kind of local comparisons. Mm-hmm. One of the dramatic things we found, unexpected things we found in this 2004 survey was that rural people actually had more positive views of current inequalities than urban people, even though rural people are at the bottom and urban people are at the top. But in 2004, it was just at the end of Jurongji's smashing the Iron Rice Bowl. Been since the late 1990s, a big wave of xiagang, of laying off workers, people's jobs in jeopardy, and so forth. So that the urban people, even though the system had favored them mostly, at that point, they had kind of more sour views. Whereas on the other side, in the countryside, if you've been a commune member and you were not able to leave the village at all, it was a system of what I would call socialist serfdom. Commune members were bound to the soil. They were not able to decide, I want to go off and look for a job elsewhere, change, I want to leave farming, I want to go into the cities and look for opportunities. That was all prohibited under Mao. So the much greater multiple opportunities, even if those are not equal opportunities to what city people have produced an overall optimism about opportunities of getting ahead in the countryside in 2004 that was greater than people. So the subjective factors of recent experiences and expectations and what other people you knew, what was happening to them, that trumps what the overall indicators of the economy are.
Marty, this suggests it's both a bad news and a good news story. I think that what you've presented to us this morning is an awareness of both the complexity that we're dealing here with, if you will, a kind of a moving target in a lot of respects. But I think you've enlightened all of us in very, very useful ways as a first speaker at our conference. So to keep us on schedule, since we have a very full morning discussion, we'll conclude now, and I'm sure maybe in the coffee break or whatever, people might be able to ask you other questions that they might have. So let us all give our speaker a good round of applause.
Thank you very much.
Please be seated. We will have a coffee break in this after the first panel. And for now, let's continue. Yes. And for panelists, please be also seated. Yeah. Okay. You wait. Okay. Sorry. I correct myself. Thank you.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. It's my honor to have the opportunity to coordinate this panel. 35 years have passed since China has adopted the opening and reform policy in 1978. Great change has taken place. Currently, as we all know, China has become the second largest economy around the world. Skyscrapers are rising up in Beijing and Shanghai rapidly, and people have become richer and learn more about the world. Of course, there are more corruption, protest, and inequality. But I believe what have changed the most is the people. When the college entrance examination was renewed in 1977 in China, only 270,000 young people got the chance to get into colleges. In 2013, by contrast, nearly 7 million high school seniors have taken higher education. In 1977, few Chinese people have the opportunity to come to America. However, in 2013, about 160,000 Chinese students rushed into American universities. In spite of this, young people from urban and rural areas still share different opportunities. Even at Tsinghua University, where I'm from, some freshmen from big cities are quite familiar with computer and internet when they were kids, and some others from rural areas have low access to computer at all before college. Young people from rural areas have fewer opportunities to enroll in colleges, especially elite universities. How about the social mobility in China today? On the one hand, young people are usually sources of innovation. Almost all great enterprises are given birth by young people, such as Microsoft, Facebook, Taobao, and Baidu. They have their dreams, and they are also the hopes for a better life for the human beings in the future. On the other hand, young people are also creators of social movement, stability, even revolution. They are more likely to be critical to reality and take actions to fight it. For instance, one of the major causes of the Egyptian Revolution in 2011 is the high unemployment rate of young people. The recent Sunflower Movement in Taiwan is another example of the political express of the youth in policymaking. In the past half a year, migrant workers who worked for orders from Nokia, Nike, and IBM went on strike in southern China. Most of them are young people. The lifestyles of young migrant workers differ from those of their parents significantly. They pay more attention to work conditions, spend more time on internet, and are reluctant to go back to rural areas. Correspondingly, their parents are more prone to tolerant any terrible working conditions in order to earn more money to feed their kids and build big houses in their hometown. So how about the political opinions and the behavior moods of the youth? How about the opportunity equality standards for young people in China? All these are very important issues we should pay more attention in contemporary China. Fortunately, today we have invited three needy scholars who have done excellent research on the youth. They have just completed a survey on the young generation in China recently. They are all from the Department of Youth Studies and Social Problems in Chinese Academy of Social Sciences, Institute of Sociology. Firstly, let's invite Professor Li to share her perspectives and research findings. Please keep your presentation in 12 minutes so that we can have more time for discussion. Thank you.
Good morning. Sorry, my voice have a problem because I cough. And it is a great honor for me to give a talk on Chinese youth here. And thanks, Chen Li, invite my colleagues and I visit Brookings and show you our research findings. And also, thanks, Professor Martin White, to give a broadly and extensive discussion about Chinese youth. And now I'm continue to discuss the topic Martin already talk. I didn't know you talk this topic. If I know, I change my topic. But anyway, I provide you some survey data to support your views. You know, that is a new type of urban-rural separation among the younger generation. Socioeconomic disparity between urban and rural residents is one of the most prominent inequalities in China. That is partly because of the long-term implement of hukou system, which resulted obvious separation between the urban society and the rural society. Some people say two China, urban China and rural China. There has long been apparently socioeconomic distinction between the urban and the rural people. Since the beginning of the economic reform, the hukou system has been loosening. So now, today, there's free labor migration from the rural areas to cities, which has brought about a huge rural and urban migration. And at the same time, the opportunities of employment, education, and social welfare in cities opening gradually to the migrants from the rural areas. So what has happened when urban and rural boundary gradually fade? May today's young people share similar opportunities, no matter they are from urban and rural areas. But Martin already gave the answer. Today's Chinese youth is composed of two age groups, post-80s and post-90s, who are born during the 1980s and the 1990s. So the total number of the younger generation is 403 million. It's nearly one-third of total population. Unrechart policy began to implement it in early 1980s. However, the policy has been implemented more strictly in cities than rural areas. Rural families usually had more children than one. So in the figure, you will find, do you have the light? There is a, can you use? You will fear the young people from the rural family, only 19% from the only child families. But urban, the young people from the urban family have a much high percentage from one child in the families. Most of the post-80s and the post-90s are not from one-child family. Only 27.5% of young people are only child in their family. because of unreached policy, more young people from the rural families than the urban families. About 77% of the post-80s and 69% of the post-90s are from the rural families. These ratios are even higher than their parent generation. Although most of the younger people born in the rural areas and hold rural hukou, they are now migrating into the cities. In 2013, more than two-thirds of post-80s and post-90s live in cities. Only 31% of young people living in rural area, but most of them in industrialized rural areas and working factory there. Only 8% working in agriculture. So young people, young generation is concentrated in cities, especially larger cities. Although the young people from migrating into cities from rural areas, but they hold the rural hukou. So that means they have not legal citizen status in cities. So that result is a new type of urban-rural separation among the young generation. The urban-rural separation moving into the cities. This new type of urban-rural separation splitting the younger generation into two major groups. One is migrant workers, less educated young people from rural areas, rural families, and another group is younger people with high education, college students and graduates. So by this way, the urban-rural disparity transferring from older generation to the younger generation. Among total number of younger generation, about 25% are high-educated young people. Another about 45% are migrant workers. In cities, 42% are college students and graduates, and 44% of migrant workers. So that means about 70% of young people are now in cities. Among them, a half are high-educated people. Another half is migrant workers in city. Both groups living in cities, but they are different socio-economic situation and hold very different social attitudes. When we're talking about how our Chinese youth or what they think and want, we have to clear first which one it is. So this picture shows a socioeconomic distinction between high educated youth and younger migrant workers in cities. The younger migrant workers have much higher percentages than high education educated young people in the rural, holding rural hukou and living the skirt of city, in former employment and subject to unemployment and no pension, insurance, no, a lot of it. No unemployment insurance, no injury insurance, no maternity insurance, hardly reading, never using Weibo, never using email, and so on. So this socioeconomic distinction between two groups have created class differentiation. The younger graduates and the students and the graduates will be white collar workers and future members and the middle class, and the migrant workers are now a major part of a new working class. So now Chinese government leaders are talking a lot on the Chinese dream for what is the Chinese dream of the younger generation. The Chinese dream of the high-educated youth is that they eager to join the ranks of middle class. And the Chinese dream of young migrant workers is to gain citizen status and respected by local people. However, there are many handicaps clogging their dream. These handicaps have made anxiety of among young generation. Internet has becoming a place where they vent their emotions. And we have no time to talking about the detail. I just give a summary. Young generations stratified by户口 status and education. Urban-rural inequality transfer from old generation to young generation. Urban-rural separation moving into cities with migration of rural youth and creating this class differentiation among young people. New generations of middle class and working class both have strong willingness to participate in public affairs and express their views. How to meet different needs of two groups, eliminating social separation and reducing economic inequality between two groups are the challenges faced by the government. Thank you.
Thank Professor Li for your excellent work. Now we invite Professor Tianfeng to present his research work. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. My topic is the differentiation of the higher education and the potential consequences in China. Since the middle in the 1990s, China conducted a market-oriented reform of higher education. The number of the university enrollment continued to increase. Before the market-oriented reform of the higher education, some people think that China will benefit from the expansion of higher education. At least more opportunity will be provided, and it would be helpful to promote the social justice and reduce the social gap. We can see from this figure, the first is a rapid increase in the enrollment, and the number of the participants in the college entrance examination is falling in recent years, and the acceptance rate is also increasing. Which had exceeded 17%. Unfortunately, it's not the whole story. After the expansion of higher education in China, more and more people felt it is inequitable distribution of the chance of higher education. It raised a problem. Why more opportunity lead more injustice? After the founding of the PRC, as being blocked by the Western countries, China cannot obtain enough human resource from the external. It is necessary to dig from the internal. The traditional social elite had been eliminated during the civil revolution. So the only way to select the social elite from the workers and the peasant families. After a few decades of the accumulation, a new social elite had been formed. Even there is no high education expansion, the new social elite will also take advantage of the university as the tool of the elite self-reproduction. It is said that the social function of China high education system has changed from the elite recruitment to the elite reproduction. For the purpose of the reproduction, the high education system become even more clear-cut. Even more clear-cut. which means that the education system plays a role of the social differentiation, such as the K University focus on the social elite, and the vocational college focus on the technical training. That is said, before the students enter the labor market, they have been distributed in the different of the social classes. Let me introduce our survey. Our survey is a panel study of the China University students, which is a proposal to following students from the universities and the colleges to observe the critical period in the life course from the campus to career. The survey is conducted by the Institute of the Sociology, China Academy of Social Sciences. It started from the 2013, mixed of the typical sampling and the random sampling. We select 12 respective universities, and in each university, use stratified random sampling to extract students. In the first round survey, 2013, we got about 7,875 valid samples. The response rate is about 73.9. My research is based on our panel study of the university students survey data. Now we look at the background of the students in the universities and colleges. We found that the opportunities to enter the K university for the student who come from the disadvantaged families is significantly low. The proportion of the rural students in the K university, general university, and the vocational colleges is in a ascending order. We can see that if we look at this is before they go to the university, where they live, where they residence. This is the household, the hukou. This is the father's occupation. So we use these three measurements. We can see that the students come from the rural will have low opportunity to go to the K university. And most of them is in the vocational college. As we know, the K university's social function is mainly focused on the elite education in China today. So this kind of situation means that it's a very clear cutoff of the social mobility. Given the difference of the family background, it's not surprising that the expenditure are quite different. You can see that the K university's students spend more money than the general university and the vocational college students. However, if only compared with the tuition, the vocational college is the most expensive. It's quite unreasonable. The worst higher education costs the most. As we all know, in order to increase the supply of the higher education, the government always subsidizes the universities and the colleges. And the high-level institute in China, its total subsidized will also high. So under the vocational college cannot survive if they do not charge more money from the students. But you know, in the vocational colleges, the students always come from the poor families. So it's very unreasonable. Let's look at another thing is political participation. Whether in a K university or in a vocational colleges, submitting an application to join the party is quite common. From the data analysis, the proportion of K universities, students who have submitted an application to join the party is the lowest, while the highest proportion of the party membership. The proportion of the vocational college students who submit an application to join the party is more than the K university, but the proportion of the party members is much less than the K universities. The party membership is a political identity. And the political identity is becoming an important prerequisite of the political elite. In recent years, students, the college students and the university students, become the major source of the new party members. But the motivation of the student to join the party is always controversial. But whatever the motive is, the university become more or less a political elite screen mechanism. especially in the K universities, which have a low proportion application and but high proportion of the party membership. What does this mean? Obviously, the party prefer to select the new members who is considered as a political elite from the K university student, who is more likely to become economic elite and the culture elite. It can be predicted that in China, the political elite will mix with the culture elite or the economic elite. As I just said, the party prefer to recruit a new member from the K university student, but it's a kind of one-way trust. Because of the survey issues that the students of the K university think the government and the official organization are more distrustful. On the contrary, the students from the vocational college think that the government and the official organization are more trustable. So that is not a mutual trust between the government and the students. This is about the subculture of the youth. Almost all the students in the college and university are post 90s. So their subculture is definitely different with other cohort groups. Consider that this period is critical for their whole life because their values are forming in the universities and the colleges. The government put much effort to implant their ideas in the youth through the TV and the movies. But the survey data shows that in the key universities, the American drama and the movies are more popular than the China dramas and the movies. In the contrast, the China dramas and the movies are more popular in the vocational college students. So it's a little different with what the government is thinking. Oh, the last part is about the job. Because of the youth, employment is a global social problem. Our survey focuses on the quality of the employment and the satisfaction of the employment. According to the survey, the average income of the first job of the K university is the highest, and the general university is a low, and the vocational colleges is the lowest. And also we can see that the students graduate the K university has more opportunity to enter the state honor unit. You know, in China, state honor unit is has much power and much money than the private factor. The last is the satisfaction of the first job. And we can see that the K university gets them much more satisfied with their first job than the general university students and the vocational college students. So what's the potential consequence? I think the first one is a clear cut of national high education system may be lead to social groups against each other. The second is that on the surface, the expansion of the higher education bring more chance to enter the college and the university. But actually, the high education system exacerbate the social inequality in China. That's all. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Professor Tian, for your very interesting presentation. There are a lot of numbers. I believe there will be a lot of questions around it. Our last but not the least panelist is Professor Zhu. Yeah, please.
Good morning. It's very nice to meet everyone here. So the title of my presentation is When Chinese Youth Meet Globalization and Commercialization from the Perspective of Structural Effects. So mainly I'm going to talk about how the structural factors shape consumer culture of the Chinese youth using the empirical data. So there are several important structural factors to shape youth consumption practices. The first one is their family background. Whether they are from a rich or relatively deprived family background, or whether they are from urban or rural areas. And another factor is their university type, which university they go to. So whether they are studying a key university or a our vocational college, which is at the bottom of the university hierarchy. And the third factor is the city. So where the university is, whether it is in the tier one city, I mean the metropolitan cities like Beijing, Shanghai, and Guangzhou, or whether they live in a less developed city. I will explain more later. So the data, I'm using the same data with my colleagues, and I mainly use the data on purchase and use of mobile phones. So first graph, we can see that there is some differentiation with the ownership of smartphones with among the students. So if students from a higher family income, there is a high percentage of ownership of smartphones. We can see the green bar, which is students from the family of income above 10,000 yuan. So this graph tells us the ownership of their mobile phone brands among the students. We can see for the international big brands like Samsung, iPhone, and even Nokia, there is a high percentage of students. There is a high percentage of these international big brands among students from Tier 1 and the Tier 2 cities, which is the metropolitan cities and the more developed cities in China. And students from the Tier 3 cities, that is less developed cities in China, so they tend to own Chinese brands and some smaller international brands. However, in terms of what they want, we see a homogeneous taste here. Yes. So all of the students want, So students want the Samsung and iPhone most. If the questionnaire asks, what do you want most, regardless your affordability? So, comparatively, other international brands and Chinese brands are less popular with the students. However, we see a small peak at Xiaomi. I should explain here. So Xiaomi is a young Chinese company. They produce smartphones at a lower cost. So you can buy a decent smartphone like at $120, something like that. So it's quite popular among students from tier 3 cities and the college students, which they tend to be less affluent. So this graph shows the addiction to mobile phones, which is quite stunning. Yeah. Over 50% of students show different extents of addiction to mobile phones. So like, I feel uncomfortable if I don't bring a phone with me, or I feel anxious if my phone cannot connect to the internet. But if the students from a better off family background, I mean, if they are from urban areas or they come from a family with a higher income, they tend to be more addicted to mobile phones. Well, this finding actually is quite interesting because I read a paper from a Korean researchers. They find the opposite finding. They find that students from a more deprived family background, they are more addicted to mobile phones. So, but I haven't found how to, I haven't found out how to explain this. So maybe you can give me some hints how to explain this. So, and this graph shows the impact of father's education on the influence of mobile phones that is sensed by the students. So, although these lines are most stacked, we can see the purple line, which is a higher father's education, that is postgraduate and above. The students sense a lower percentage of the negative influence from mobile phones, like cause distraction in class or cause distraction when study, or become less intimate with family and friends. This negative influence, so it's a lower percentage of negative influence sensed by students from a family with a higher father's education. However, they feel a higher percentage of the positive influence, like increase in knowledge and information. So a possible explanation might be students with a higher father's education, their parents are more likely to use smartphones and mobile phones frequently themselves. So they will feel ease using these new products, and they will pass on this quite relaxing and this kind of emotion onto their children. So these mobile phones won't cause much negative influence to their children. And this graph shows the consumer orientation among the students. So it shows a very high percentage of the self-referential orientation. That is, the quality of function are practical, the design is aesthetic and refined, and the performance price ratio fits me. So this kind of consumer orientation emphasizes the personal pleasure and comfort rather than social status or social identity, like I have face when using it. Well, it's quite Chinese expression. That means it gives me, I feel very good and very confident when using this mobile phone, and it makes me, it shows off my social status. And the other, and also it shows young people's taste and everybody's using it. So these are all different consumer orientation from the self-referential orientation. But this percentage is relatively lower. And this finding is confirms a finding from some market research in China. Findings show that young people, especially the post-80s generation, okay, thank you, especially the post-1980s generation, they kind of embrace this self-referential orientation, which they would emphasize their self-rewards, their self-identity, and their self-satisfaction in their consumption. So this finding is quite consistent with the market research findings. And for the face consumption, for this face consumer orientation, so students from a better off family background, they are more enthusiastic about face consumption. Students from the urban areas, or they have from a family with a higher income, so they tend to be more enthusiastic about the face consumption. I have faced when using it, so when we ask their motive of buying the mobile phone. So, and also, with the higher father's education, students tend to be less enthusiastic about face consumption. So if father's education grows from primary school to college, students become more enthusiastic about face consumption. However, if their father's education grows from college to university and even to postgraduate level, so they become not that keen on the face consumer orientation. That may be because with a higher education, their father and their parents tend to be more kind of low-key, or they are better educated, so they wouldn't bother to show off their social status. Everyone knows here. Everyone here knows about it. So, and the findings. And so when Chinese youth meet globalization and commercialization, so addiction to mobile phones are significant among Chinese university students. And the percentage of owning smartphones is high. The international Vanguard brands are the most popular with Chinese university students. Chinese young cool brands at reasonable price are rising. So in purchase of mobile phones, Chinese university students are generally rational, moderate, and are keen on the self-referential orientation. And the structural effects. So students from better off family background or live in metropolitan cities are more involved in modern consumer culture, like addiction and this kind of face consumption or consumerism, if we talk about this their consumer culture. So those from less well off background or live in smaller cities stick to frugality and utility. So families' cultural capital have impact on material culture and consumer orientation of the Chinese youth. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Zhu. Now I would like to invite all the panelists to join me to the front stage so we can move to the Q&A session. Congratulations for your excellent presentations. Before the floor is open for questions, I would like to ask two questions. The first question is for Professor Li. You classified young people in two dimensions. One is his origin, a rural area or urban area. The other is his occupation, white-collar worker or migrant worker. My question is, if a student from rural area get enrollment in certain college, he got a job in Beijing and after graduation, and he cannot get Beijing hukou and become a so-called H or Beipiao. Which category does he belong to? My second question is for Professor Tian. You concluded in your presentation that higher education system exacerbated social inequality in China. Let's take Tsinghua University as an example. In recent years, we have launched several programs to give students from rural areas more opportunity for admission. But you know, in China, if a student cannot get a higher score in the college entrance examination, we cannot admit him only because he come from rural areas. The situation is quite different that in United States. We know that in USA, Harvard and Princeton will reject half of the applicants who get a full score in SAT, but Chinese universities cannot do so. So my question is, is such a kind of inequality caused by pre-college education or just higher education? Thank you.
Sorry, my colleagues and I will answer question in Chinese and ask Translator, OK. 就是郭教授他提的问题是说，就说如果这个是农村的孩子，他获得了大学文凭以后会属于哪个群体？对，确实在这刚才我说的两个群体中间，实际上有一个处于两个群体之间的一个边缘群体，就是现在所谓的这些来自农村的这些大学毕业生，他们呢现在被媒体，就是他们当中的一大部分啊，是被媒体称作是蚁族，或者说是北漂，就是一些农村的孩子要改变他们的身份，是通过高等教育是一个很重要的一个途径，
So I'm basically responding to Mr. Professor Kuo's question here, and his question was about how the rural students fared after they have obtained their college diploma and they found a job in Beijing. And he also asked me about the two groups of students or peoples that I was talking about in my lecture, in my presentation. Basically, there's actually between these two groups is what we call a marginal group. Between these two groups, they are mostly college graduates from the rural areas in China, and for them to change their status from being able to enjoy the Foucault perks, so to speak, having obtained a higher education diploma is actually key to how they might be able to transfer their status from one to another.
政府领导人认为是一个具有高潜在的社会不稳定因素。
My colleague Professor Tian actually had mentioned that in his presentation that there was this group of rural students that came to study in the universities and colleges in the cities, and they usually went to lower-tier colleges, and therefore when they graduated, it would be very difficult for them to achieve upward mobility. In other words, they were less competitive, and they also do not have any kind of family networks or guanxi that can help them to find a better jobs, and usually they got a job that is lower paid and not exactly stable. So they had become this very big group in big cities and metropolitan areas, and in other words, they, in terms of their income, they are low-income people from the rural areas, but they are also more highly comparatively more highly educated. And so the Chinese government has seen this group as a potential group that may cause a social instability in China.
这个群体他们有比较强的这个社会的不满情绪，而且最容易在网络上发表一些比较极端的这个言论。那么现在政府呢，采取一些措施，希望能够帮助他们就业和改进他们的生活状况。
So this group, they have shown to be people who are quite dissatisfied with the social status, and they are usually the ones who present quite extreme comments through online channels. And so the government now is trying to implement programs that will help to raise their living standard and also to give them better jobs so as to kind of pacify them.
刚才国教授提的问题，我想是这样的，就是在中国现在不仅仅在大学阶段有这种不平等，在高中和这个初中，包括义务教育阶段都有这种不平等的存在。已经在中国可能已经很少见的这个辍学，在近几年反而有了，这更加上升的这种势头，就是从初中生辍学然后去打工。其实这个问题的关键所在是有两个层次的原因。第一个层次的原因是，现在农村的学生去上大学，他的教育回报率是非常低的。 农村学生上大学，他的教育的回报率是非常低的。从个人理性的角度来讲，现在农村的孩子不愿意去考大学，所以他们就不去考高中，高中都不去考。第二个角度来讲，是中国的政策的整个教育政策的改革没有考虑到弱势群体。比方说，我们在地方上的撤，这个叫做撤乡并镇之后的学校合并，学校合并之后导致农村的孩子上学是非常困难，他要走可能 很远，几十里的路，几十公里的路去上学，我觉得这是两方面的原因造成的。
So this kind of dissatisfaction or this kind of sentiments or emotions not only occur in colleges in China, but now also in high schools or upper middle school or lower middle schools in China. Basically, the key to this problem, we can look at it from two perspectives. One is that you know that when rural students go to college and get a diploma, the rate of returns for them is actually quite low, and therefore most of them are now not incentivized to go to colleges. And in fact, as a result of that, they are also not quite interested in going to high schools. I think this also has to do with the education policy reform in China. For example, when they combine the schools, this would create hardship for students from the rural areas because it means that, that they have poor transportation system. That means they have to walk a very, very long way, sometimes dozens of meters, miles, to, in order to attend school every day.
Okay, thank you for your feedback. Now the floor is open for questions. Please introduce yourself briefly before you ask questions, and I will be appreciated if you can keep the questions and answers short. The lady in the middle, please. Yeah.
My name is Song Yu. I'm an MA candidate at Teachers College, Columbia University. Thanks for the very informative session. You know, my typing skills can barely keep up with the presentation. So much resources has been given to higher education, and which makes sense, you know, because empirical studies prove the gap, you know, between rural kids and like urban kids in terms of life quality. But for me, I feel like the real problem and the real solution really lies in secondary education. Without proper schooling, you know, like rural or region youth, there's no way for them to compete with their urban kids and, you know, therefore having no access to higher education. So my question is, like, do you mind, like, you know, sharing with us what has been done to close the gap between urban or region youth and rural, like, youth in terms of secondary education? Thank you.
Who do you want to answer the question? it's okay.
Sorry. 最近十几年是中国的这个政府采取的大学扩招政策。提供了大量的这个高等教育的机会，那么农村的孩子也分享到一部分的这个机会，但是大学扩招并没有造成这个城乡的教育机会差异的缩小，尽管越来越多的农村孩子上大学的这个数量是增长了，但是城乡之间的教育机会的这个差距还在继续的扩大，这也是一个很大的原因，是农村的孩子和他们的父母是上大学的愿望下降，是由于高等教育的回报率的下降，对他们来说啊，找工作你获得了大学文凭，找工作还是很困难。另外就是上中学受中等教育的时候，这个变得更加困难，就像撤点并校这个教育政策，导致一些对农村的孩子来说上学更加的困难。所以这个是导致最近十几年，尽管大学教育机会翻倍的增长，增长很快，但是城乡之间的差异还在继续扩大。那么教育呢扩张并没有导致城乡差异的缩小，反而是加剧。
So in the last few decades, educational reform policy of China has created many opportunities for higher education for both the rural areas and the urban areas. And as a result of that, rural students have been able to obtain some of these opportunities. However, what I want to stress here today is that this kind of expansion of higher education to rural students have not been able to close the gap for urban-rural disparity in terms of education. So part of the reasons, as we had mentioned earlier, is that the rate of return of obtaining a college diploma is really low, and also it's very difficult to find a job, even if you have completed colleges. So the parents, rural parents, do not quite encourage the kids to go to school because they believe that, first of all, the rate of return is low, and then disparity, therefore, as a result, has not been narrowed.
Okay, one more question. Maybe the gentleman in the front.
Sorry, I have a question again. Thank you very much for your presentation. I guess I have a question for Professor Zhu. So in your presentation, you mentioned your study between father's education level and their kids' performance with cell phones and et cetera. So my question is, what happens to mother's education, especially when I have my, my girlfriend here with me from Georgetown, which she believes is better than George Washington with the same degree, but you know. So my question would be, do you see that correlation between father's education level and their kids' performance itself as a problem in China now in terms of opportunities for young Chinese women or girls, especially we actually see two of our panelists, two out of three are women. So what's your opinion on gender inequality for Chinese youth? Thank you.
It's a broad topic that I talked about. Well, gender, you mean the impact of father's education on mother's education? So what kind of thing you meant is a ownership of smartphones or influence of smartphones or To be honest, I didn't analyze the impact of mother's education, but from the from my experience, probably because apparently, China is still male-dominated society. So, I think why I measure the influence or ownership of smartphones from father's education is mainly because the assumption that we think the father's education has more impact to the family's economic social status than mother's education. That's why I measured from the perspective of father's education. But I agree with that the mother education, the impact of mother's education is growing significantly in recent decades. Because I read a lot of research and newspapers, they all claim that the impact of mother's education on everything like child's, like not included, not limited to their use of smartphones, but from their intellectual achievement or their even their social status achievement. So I believe, yeah, sure, mother education has certain impact on their ownership and the use of mobile phones. But I'm sorry, I can't give empirical findings here. But if you can, I can email you. We can talk about later.
The lady in the middle. Okay.
Okay. Excuse me. My name is Beverly Hong Fincher, Hong Yue Bi. So your answer can be in Chinese also. Maybe it will make the translator work harder. Anyway, I'm very pleased about all your presentations. And there's only one thing, and I'm continuing his remarks. I mean, in your data, you seem to have missed out the gender thing. Like the college graduates or the college entering students, but you did not include gender as one. I just wonder how many college graduates are, I mean, in the U.S., we know, it's overwhelming different. But in China, I would like to know. Okay, thank you.
Yeah. 我们做这个大学生这个调查的一个主要的一个问题之一。 而且现在也是中国社会面临挑战的一个问题，现在不是女孩子受教育机会少于男孩子，现在在教育机会竞争当中是女孩子比男孩子更强，所以现在出现的中国社会的一个问题叫男孩危机，不管是从。 男孩危机，对，不管从幼儿园开始，一直到上大学开始，到上大学。 都是女孩子的这个竞争力更强，获得更高的分数，获得更高的机会。所以现在在大学生的总数当中，女生是超过男生，但是男孩危机倒过来，女孩子的这个教育竞争的这个优势，反而造成了女孩子在就业市场上，变成弱势，越来越多的女大学生，而劳动力市场，需要的白领的员工希望更多的男生，所以女孩子女大学生人数增长的同时带来的一个问题是女大学生就业越来越困难，出现了非常明显的公开的对女大学毕业生的就业歧视。
So the gender issue has been one of our priorities in when we carried out our studiesand our research. And currently the problem is not that women are less, have less opportunities for education. In fact, women are actually more competitive than men in terms in the area of education. And so that's why we call it the male gender crisis. In fact, if you look at the data from kindergarten to college, you can see that women actually are more competitive. They always score higher and they have better opportunities. And in fact, there are more women now in China who go to college than men. However, it, as far as satisfying the demand of the labor market now is looking for more white collar males. And so it actually has, put the female college graduates in a disadvantage because there are now obvious and open discriminations against women college graduates.
还要补充一点，补充一句，虽然从总数上来说，女孩子上大学的机会多于男生，但是有明显的城乡差异。城市家庭出身的女孩子是上大学的机会明显多于男生，但是在农村出身的孩子里面，女生还是弱势，还是有性别的不平等。
And one more thing that I need to add on is that even though in general, there are more women now who go to college than men in China, but it was very clear that there is still urban and rural disparity in a sense that there are more, among all these women graduates, most of them came from the cities and not the rural areas.
Professor Li, I totally agree with you because we can find there are more women than men here in the front stage, right? Maybe one more question. Okay. Maybe we will give more opportunity for people sit at the back. Maybe the gentleman. Yeah. Okay.
My name is Jin Guanghong. I came from China. I have been a college teacher in Xiamen University for more than 10 years. University authority don't like what I taught to my students, so I was fired. After that, I became a human rights lawyer in Beijing for several years. But Chinese government I defended the constitutional rights of political dissidents and religious dissidents. But Chinese government also don't like what I did. So 1 year ago, I came to U.S. I have two questions. One question is, what's the political attitude of Chinese students and Chinese youth, such as democracy, human rights? Two questions is, how government policy affect Chinese students' planning of life, career, such as a job, marriage and how to choose which city to inhabit. Thank you.
The first question is about graduate students' political attitude. Later, our colleague Lü Peng will explain to you a political attitude. He has a PPT. Later, he will talk. So I will not answer.然后第二个问题呢是关于这个大学生就业， 其实现在的大学生就业，首先我们看国家做了什么。其实在国家这个层面上花了很多的功夫去做这些工作，但是由于中国的现在就业的整个它的产业结构的升级并没有完全实现，所以在产业结构的层面来说是不利于大学生就业的，它还是依赖这种农民工就业的这种劳动密集型的产业。另外一个方面呢，就是说我们大学生本身的这个就业观念也需要有一个转变。现在大学生，因为之前的大学生是非常的少，他我们称为天之骄子，他就业是非常容易的。但现在大学生已经比之前多了20倍的大学生，就意味着你已经不是天之骄子了，你要把自己的心态放下来，然后你去找一些工作，可能适合你的不一定是最好的。我们的调查也发现，其实在就业的过程当中，当然我没有在这展示这个数据，在就业的过程当中，我们重点大学的学生的就业率和高职学生的就业率都是非常高的，反而夹在中间的普通大学的学生的就业率是非常低的。这就是说明普通大学它在这个转变的过程中，普通大学的这个就业观念它没有转变过来。所以我想这是两方面的问题，一方面是政府，一方面是个人。谢谢。
So there seems like there are two parts of the question. And the first part is about the college policy, so I will leave that out. But I will answer to the second part of the questions about how college graduates fare in China. I believe that the government has done quite a bit in terms at the national level. However, I think that it's because the industrial structure of China has not been able to follow suit in terms of reform or not been upgraded enough. So there now we're seeing less and less labor-intensive industries in China, and that also means that it's harder to find a particular kind of jobs if you are not at a certain educational level. The other things that I think for college students or graduates, I think we need to change our mindset altogether, because in the past you had very rare opportunities to go to college, and so when you graduated, you see yourself as someone very special, like the sons of heaven. But now everyone goes to college, everyone wants a job, and you're no longer the sons of heaven. So you should find a job that is suitable for you, like an entry-level job, instead of something that's glamorous right away. And so I think that currently job opportunities may be decreasing for people coming from key universities and maybe high schools, but it is those who are in the middle that came from general universities and colleges that actually are still able to find jobs.
Let's move on. Okay. The lady. Yeah.
Hi, thank you, the panelists today, for your speech. And I'm a master's student in University of Maryland, and I'm getting a doctoral program soon in Boston College this fall. So my question is about, like, with the demographic transition in recent 20 years, like, there's more and more elderly people in a society, and the population aging is becoming a tremendous issue in our society. And I wonder that with this social phenomenon, whether it has any impact on the youth mobility in our society. Because it's very common that in our generation, there are more and more sandwich generation. So it means that we need to take care of our parents as well as our children. So it's two person take care of four elderly people as well as their children. So it's very precious for us, and also especially for the children in the rural areas, their parents are less well off compared with the urban areas. So does it mean that it adds extra burden to those youth from the rural areas, that they are more likely to be constrained in their hometown? So I wonder that, do you have related research to deal with this like democratic transition? Thank you.
对，那个您的意思我大概听懂了哈。因为我的以前是学 demography 的，所以这个代际关系其实是我们这个调查关注的非常重要的一个内容。在我们这个观察的当中呢，其实我们也知道中国现在面临的最大的问题可能不是经济增长问题，而是老龄化问题。老龄化问题对中国的影响是非常深入的，其实从欧洲的经验来看，可能老龄化对整个国家的影响都非常的大。但是就是说 如果说老龄化和这个青年人之间的这个，尤其是青年人流动之间的相互关系来看呢，其实在中国的这个代际关系当中，很大一部分是老人要 ，OK， 老人是需要牺牲自己的，因为他是在老的过程当中，老人是会放弃自己的利益，允许孩子去流动，而且中国的很多的老人他会觉得孩子流动出去去了大城市，获得更好的工作是一个非常有面子的问题。非常有面子的事情，反而呢留在小城市可能他会这样。而且另外一方面，中国现在从家庭的生命周期来看，青年人离开老年人的家庭的时间是非常早的，平均下来也就是二十五六岁。在二十五六岁的时候，按中国的平均结婚年龄来看，老年人还没有进入真正的老年，他也就是在五十二三岁的时候，他的孩子就已经可以离开他了。而且他在那个时候的话，他没有很多的这个养老方面的负担。所以中国的，您刚才提到的中国那个老龄就是说我们经常说的四二幺这个问题，其实是一个伪命题。在我们的真正的家庭结构当中，就是出现四二幺这种家庭结构，基本上出现的可能性大概不到20%。
四二幺。
对，四二幺。就四个老人，然后两个成年人，一个孩子。
这不是真正的问题。
对对，不是
还不是真正的问题。Okay, so yeah, she was asking a question on the aging population in China, which is actually one of our top concerns as well, because we think that this will be one of the major challenges that China is going to face, and also its impact is going to be very deep and very wide, and we can see this from the examples in among the European countries. So I think that aging population is actually going to be quite important and quite significant.For a country. I think in China we have always this mentality or this concept that the older ones or the older generation should sacrifice for the younger generations. And so to them it's still quite a thing for the face, or it's quite a glorious thing if your younger generations go out of the rural areas and go to cities and find very good jobs. If you look at the family cycle in China, basically nowadays the youth leave their families quite young, and they are around 25 to 26 years old in China. They would get married and they would have their own family. By that time, the parents would probably be at around 52 years old to 53 years old. So they're still not, basically the need to retire and take care of themselves as they age. The idea has not quite hit them yet. And so I think the so-called structure of 4-2-1 is not really an impending problem yet. As far as what we're looking at the situation currently is concerned, I don't think it's yet a problem.
Okay, one last quick question, because we have only 1 minute left, right? Okay, it's okay. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Tenzin, and I'm a local DC Tibetan. So my question is actually for all the panel members. I'd like to know if in your individual surveys you took ethnicity into consideration, and if yes, have you found that to be a factor in the gaps you've been speaking of? And if you did not take ethnicity into consideration, then what was the reason for not doing so? Thank you.
我说一下吧，他两个问题，一个就是说你们在进行这个调查的时候，有没有把这个民族这个 ethnicity 这个部分呢当作是研究的一个部分，那如果有的话，那你认为呢他是否在这个城乡这个教育差距里面呢起什么样的作用，那如果你们没有把这一块包含进去的话，那是什么原因没有把它包含进去？
实际上在我们的调查当中是有你是从哪个民族来的这样的一个问题，但是你知道中国的高考制度是对少数民族是有优待的这个制度，所以这个问题在造成这个社会不平等方面其实是一个反向的不平等，是对汉族的学生是不平等的。我想我应该是大概回答了你的问题，而且这个需要说明的是，其实在我们的调查当中有比较大比例的民族学生，但是我们没有把它作为一个专门的变量来分析，因为那个分析可能跟你想象的这个少数民族会处于弱势是相对反一些，相反过来，因为他的入学分数会很低。
没听，就说
我不好意思，我再说一次啊，就是说现在我们的调查当中是有民族这个变量，但是呢，由于中国的政府是在少数民族高考当中有很多的优惠的政策，在由于这种政策造成呢，其实是对数量更多的汉族的学生是不平等。比方说，在高考的过程当中，可能同样一个学校，少数民族的学生可能要比汉族要分数要低，所以这个本身它造成的这个不平等是在这个高等教育这个阶段是看不出来的，可能它会在高中或者是这个更低的这个层次能够看出来，但在高考这个环节，只要参加高考的反而是对汉族的不平等。
明白。Yes, we did consider ethnicity in our studies, and we did include this, what we call the ethnicity variable, in our studies. But you may understand that, in China, we have, many programs that are, in the interest or in, to the advantage of, minorities, sort of like the affirmative actions in the United States. So a lot of people see those programs as being unfair to the Han group. For example, when they take the entrance exam, the threshold for minorities is actually lower.
Okay. Now we have 10 minutes coffee break. Before that, I would invite to join me to give big hands to all the panelists for their excellent work. Thank you.
Let me eject your thing. There we go. Okay. Thank you.
你 been like the PowerPoint 有没有问题？
Both.
But 他们都有。 还没到。这不关。It's okay. Don't worry.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay. LEI. Okay, I got it. Yeah, LEI.
Okay, if everyone can please take your seats, we're going to get started with our next panel.
Yes, I just did.
Okay, everyone, please take your seats.
Okay, it's all yours.
Okay, good morning. If you could all take your seats, it would be much appreciated so that we can stick to this tight schedule here. So first of all, I'd just like to say good morning and thank you to the Brookings Institution for hosting this wonderful event. I very much look forward to seeing the presentations of this second group of panelists. But by way of introduction, I'd like to just make three sort of brief remarks about youth and digital media use in China today. To begin, I would like to highlight the issue of politics. So I think there is a tendency to see today's youth as relatively materialistic, shallow, and apolitical. Described as the me generation, scholar Stanley Rosen notes that they are widely criticized for being, quote, China's first generation of couch potatoes, addicts of online games, patrons of fast food chains, and loyal audiences of Hollywood movies, end quote. And while he notes that youth have in recent years exhibited an increased interest in joining the Communist Party, presumably for personal gain, he argues that they show a waning interest in politics. Now, is this true? Last year at MIT's Media and Transition Conference, I was struck by a comment made by Professor Henry Jenkins. Now, Jenkins argued that across the globe, youth are engaged in new forms of what he calls participatory politics, a kind of politics that takes place through online activity, including the making and sharing of viral internet memes. Jenkins notes that these are, quote, politics that often stretch beyond our institutional understanding of what constitutes the political, that involve kinds of cultural activities that invoke the production and sharing of media. Now, in the field of Chinese internet studies, Professor Yang Guobin has similarly argued that the internet is a place where contentious activity through play flourishes. My own research into sort of a group of young men who call themselves losers or diaosi further illustrates the way in which a kind of playful political participation infuses young people's engagements with digital media. And today, I think that this is something we'll hear a little bit more about from Professor Shi Yunqing. So secondly, I would like to call attention to the fact that young people's use of digital media often occurs against a backdrop of speculation and fear about the potential negative effects of this media use. Internet addiction is perceived as a common problem, and we heard previously about cell phone addiction, though it is often unclear if this is a mental disorder in and of itself or if this is a problem that is symptomatic of larger social and economic instability. Now, another common concern about digital media has to do with globalization and the cultural content of digital media that is being shared and consumed. How do socioeconomic differences play into the cultural tastes of young media consumers? Are young people today abandoning domestically produced Chinese media in favor of global media products such as American pop music or television shows? And if so, what does this mean for China in terms of its cultural or soft power? And this is a subject that we'll hear more today about from Professor Meng Lei. So finally, I'm very happy that this panel on digital media use follows the previous panel on youth mobility, because as I see it, the two are closely linked. In my own research, I have spent a number of years talking to urban Chinese youth about digital gaming, and I can say that one of the most common stories I hear has to do with the manner in which the internet cafe served as a haven for young people in the stressful years leading up to and beyond the college entrance exam. Now in the early 20s and 30s, many of these same young people are finding that digital media serve both as a tool and an outlet for coping with the pressures wrought by the intense competition for jobs, spouses, and material wealth. So to offer you one final example, in an interview with Phoenix Television, a well-known microfilm director suggested that young people's love for digital gaming was closely wedded to their lack of physical and economic mobility. He told the news station, quote, "In this day and age of growing pressures, we choose to play games because of our feelings of helplessness with regard to our real economic power. Try to imagine, if I had money to travel and surf, why would I shut myself at home in front of a computer to play games? Because the vast majority of youth living in today's world of high rents and low wages don't have that ability." So I hope this quotation can lead us to ponder the way in which digital media use links back up with the previously discussed issues of education, employment, and inequality. How do slogans such as the China Dream fit into the everyday digital realities of young Chinese netizens? And this is something, finally, that we will hear more about today from Professor Liu Peng. So having highlighted these issues, let me now turn over the podium to our three esteemed panelists. Thank you very much. And I would like to invite Professor Shi Yunqing to the podium.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm very honored to be here to share some of my ideas about the digital natives in China. And my presentation, the title is The Digital Natives in China, From Entertainment to Politics. In the past 25 years, China has experienced a very fast internet growth. In this picture, you can see the numbers, the population of the youth generation, the youth population online has increased by about six times in the last 10 years, from the 33 million to about 60 million. So the main composer of this generation are the people we call the post-80s and the post-90s. They are the children born after 1980s and the 1990s. So it may close to the Y generation or millennial generation in the U.S. Maybe another name is more familiar with you. They are Little Empire.
So basically, they are little empire in digital globalization. They have the following four features. First, they are the only child generation. So they are rich in digital resources. Here are the data from our survey. They have digital devices as average is 1.8 per person, and 50, and almost everyone own a cell phone, and 80% own a smartphone. And I want to read it. They have very most advantage in the internet access. So the red numbers are the compare numbers about the national netizens. So the second feature is the market. The rise of the consumerism give them free choices in their own preference. So this is caused the rise of individualism. And according to our survey, and these college students can adapt to the market very well. And the online shopping rate is very high. It's about 90%. So the third feature is the urbanization. When we consider about what's happening in China in last few decades, urbanization is one of the most important phenomena driven by the market economy. And also for the lifestyles, it provides the new ways for association. According to our survey, the young generation in the college, they can adapt to the social media very well, and almost 20% higher than the national numbers. The last one is globalization, which is the very close related to the rise of the internet. So this generation, the lifestyle and the subculture are affected by this information globalization. According to our data, about 38% college students like American TV series most, and others about 30 likes American and European pop music most. But my colleague Meng Lei will show more details. So about this generation and their living digital life in China, when we consider this, one of the issues we can't be ignore is the politics, because the internet born with the freedom or equality or democracy seems to be so controversial with the politic regime that featured with the centralized authority in China. But when we look at what's real happening in the daily life in China's internet, it is entertainment, not the politics, which takes up much of the time of the netizens when they are online. So about living in digital in China, it's politics or entertainment? Is it really an either-or situation or have another way? Does entertainment mean anything in China? Let's look at what the most common actives with computers in high-educated youth. This is the numbers from our survey. The first is they keep friendship. The second is get information. The third is relax and entertainment. And also, this is what they do with their cell phones. The first is chat with friends. The second is about take pictures and enjoy music. The third is about get news information and access to Weibo. And we can see most important things in digital life for college students. The first is to be social. They talk with friends or the people share with same hobbies. The second, the rest are they go for information and relax. So in the previous research, scholars usually to divide this online behavior into two categories. The first is for information. They call this as the capital enhanced behavior, which were positively related to the politics or public participation. The second, they call it as the entertainment, which will be negative related to the public participation. And about the social function, which sometimes be ascribed into the amusement part. entertainment part, but as we all know, the social ties not only provide for the satisfactory as for the public participation, it's hard to be, as for the politics, it will be hard to be measured directly. So we measured this public participation in the seven dimensions. We can divide it into the words and action part. So what we find is it's interesting, actually. The information online behavior has the positive relationship to the words, and the relaxed online behavior has positive, it's just negative to the action participation, but it has also positive relations to the words. And about the social behavior is most important. It's positive to not only the words participation, but also the participation via actions. If we go further, we can find more interesting things. When we consider who we are talking on the internet, there are basically two types. First is friends, families. Those are who we know in the real, and the internet just provide another way for we to contact with them. The second is someone we don't know in real. They are strangers online. We talk to them because we want to share the same interest and identities with them. So will this be different when we considering the public participation? So this is what I find. We find in the survey, people who talking to the friends online, they will get more positive in the words participation, but this may not affect the action participation. And the people talking to the strangers online, there seems no much difference in the words participation, but have positive relationship with the action participation. So how to explain it? The first one may be here are some details. So how to explain? The first one may be easy to understand. The people want to share their opinions with their friends. But what's the relationship with the people talking to strangers and their participation in actions? So I think, in my opinion, it's the sign of an emergence of the new social association in China. Here are two models of the social association suggested by Chinese professor Fei Xiaotong. So the first one is he used to describe what's the social association in East countries. The self is in the center, and this is a dependent self. So it like the ripples raised by the stove in the water. The layers indicate the relationships as guanxi. And the farther layer goes, the weaker the guanxi well was. So the closest layer is for family. And then go out, as they go out, the weak will be, the ties will be weak. So in this model, strangers are nowhere in these circles. So we don't have rules to instruct how to interact with strangers. So actions with strangers is very hard. But, the other graph is for the group model of associations associations, which Fei is usually to describe the group the association in the West countries. But now it seems it's emerging in China now. So in this group, the self is choose their membership by joining in online interest groups. So these circles indicate identities getting selves, and the strangers together. So this means the rise of individualism and the new social association. This will facilitating the public action. And last but not least, when we talk about the relationship between the entertainment and the political, one thing we can't be ignore is the digital content with political implications. So these are two concepts I borrow from other scholars to describe the first information paternalism is to the digital environment in China, and the second, the digital hidden transcript is about the internet culture in on China. So because the time is limiting, so I just give a very simple example of this digital hidden transcript. This young man is Han Han. He is a famous writer and a car racer, and as a spokesman for the post-80s generation. So this is an advertisement he made for a brand. made for a brand selling clothes for young generation online. So this is the slogan, love the internet, love freedom, love the net, whatever. So last, I just speak for myself. I just like you. I'm a fan ke. I'm just an ordinary traveler. So let's see what's the, what's the netizens do. This is a city inspector. Actually, he is the very concrete end of the administrative power. So his main duty is to clear off the street about the vendors. But it's caused much of the conflict in the urban area. So this is what they has to, at last they translate all these words, and at last they say, we are the city inspector, we will rule the world. So this is politics. And in a very fun and ironic way. So this is a very simple conclusion. In China, digital entitlement is related to public participation and also related to politics. Social media for friends will affect the public participation via words. That means Chinese youth is willing to get information from friends as well as share personal opinions with them. And the social media for strangers is affect the public participation via action, especially the non-conscious action. And the least youth in digital age is learning to internet with strangers through online groups with the same interest or identity. This also indicates the emergence of new social association. So at last, the digital hidden transcript is a very complex combination of entertainment and politics under Chinese context. So thank you.
All right, thank you very much, Professor Shi. And I would like to welcome Meng Lei to the podium.
Good morning. My research focuses on youth culture in China, and this article is based on an empirical study of college students' cultural consumption. Since the reform and opening up with the rapid economical development, the cultural facilities and the spiritual life of the people are getting richer and more varied. Great changes have taken place due to globalization, urbanization, and digitalization conjointly. The huge market incentive national policy and high technology push forward the cultural progress. China's special situation comes from the national condition. Several wars and cultural revolution caused the traditional cultures breaks and the cultural deprivation. So every stratum seems almost no distinction. With increasing gap between rich and poor, class differentiation manifests in the cultural field granularly. Pop culture can be traced back to the start of which is slide? Oh, okay. 1980s. A Mandarin TV series from Asia areas, just like Hong Kong, Taiwan, Singapore, became popular across the country. The audience ratings were very high, and the theme songs were seen by everyone. China's cultural productivity advanced sharply during the 90s. the imported cultural goods became plentiful. It is significant to note that the video media website has sprung up during recent years. TV plays and pop music downloads online went up at a fantastic rate. Rapid update technology supply abundant information sources, especially to young people. Convenience and liberty enable them to quickly access to the newest work. Young generation became screen Asia. This big group is consuming the cultural products from all over the world. So the multicultural contest nurtures college students to have global taste. Music, what they love is various. It's some mistake, but the Red Pole is the China pop music, and the second part is Europe and American pop music, and other is Japan, Korea pop music, even the classic Western classic music, folk and jazz, and so on. What they most enjoy is American TV series. American culture industry possesses the global leadership. That's it. Generally speaking, consumption of popular culture showed foreign competition and cultural influence. Compared with Japan and South Korea culture, European and American culture have more advantages. This conclusion is on the macro level. Next, I'll share some specific differentiation among students group. There are two main types of cultural taste. The students from rural areas related to localized preference, and the students from urban areas related to international preference. This is the rural-urban gap of cultural taste. Just like Professor Li Chunling mentioned, Hukou type urban rural is the Chinese special separation. We can see the right one. The right pool is the urban students. They are American TV. They are American TV fans, and the blue is rural students. They are the local Chinese TV series fans. This effect is very similar to music preference. If we go a step further, the family residence, the red line keep goes up is American works fans, and the blue one is Chinese works fans. and other art practice goes in a similar way. There is a high degree of uniformity between advantageous cultural capability and advantage social status. Global taste may be turned into global intellect. Thank you. And point to elite status. As Professor Tianfeng mentioned, higher college rank and more Western preference. We can see the macro level is urban, rural, and family residence. The meso level is rank of the college, and the macro level is family and the individual, including parents' education degree, family finance. This figure shows mothers' education is a contributing factor. It's a parent trend. And elite taste point to elite status, including party members and no party members. The red pole is party members. They prefer to American TV series. And the cadre, students cadre, in a similar way. Family finance. The purple curve is the American fans. Cultural difference are shaped by regional difference, globalization and urbanization. The distinction between localized taste and westernized taste have been given by social differentiation, just like urban-rural separation and original difference. Maybe there are some potential influences of cultural consumption. Our data prove the materials consumption became lifestyleized. The British and American TV fans prefer to foreign culture and lifestyle, and they express the portraying the more purchasing view of the luxury goods. And Dr. Judy just mentioned the mobile brand. Globalization brings the distinction of lifestyle and cultural taste, which will participate in the accumulation of cultural capital, point to class stratification and the reproduction of social status. We evolved into the process of globalization, cultural imperialism, neocolonialism, cultural homo hegemony theory, criticized globalization and Americanization, undermine development of other countries. But I think in China's case, international competition is challenges, but also communication. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. I would like to invite our last speaker to the podium. I wish we had more time for everybody, but hopefully we can get some more information in the question and answer session.
Okay, this part actually is divided into two issues. One is action and the other is attitudes. Action is more about social and political behaviors, and attitudes are about two issues. One is dream and the other is trust. First of all, we need to see the social and political behaviors of Chinese young people, and the data all come from the panel survey data, as my colleague has just talked about. And we can find that for the general respondents, more than 60% of them have read and searched for society political news from newspaper and magazines, and about 50% discuss public affairs with their friends and their relatives voluntarily. But just a few of them participate in social and political actions in public. We can see the data from their on the rightmost two, only 16% participate in boycott certain products, and only less than 2% have participated in any activities like protest, demonstration, and so on. But we can find that about one-third of the respondents have enthusiasm of participating in social charities and donations. And we can find that for three types of college students, students from the elite universities are more likely to read and discuss politics, while students from the junior colleges are more likely to participate in boycott and protest. And for party members, the difference actually is not very significant, but still we can find that Communist Party members in college are more likely to read politics than non-party members, while they are much less likely to participate in public actions of politics. But more interestingly, we can find that another indicator, the student association membership, is probably a more effective indicate to mirror the public participation for Chinese students. That means if you are an active member of the student association, you are more likely to participate in politics. And the membership of Communist Party is not that much apparent as many people think. And this probably is because of the more realistic attitudes of joining the party. And we can find that the action of climb the Great Firewall or jump the Great Firewall, that students who climb the Great Firewall more frequently are more likely to participate in politics. And that's the action part, and this is attitudes part. You all here might know that the Chinese dream is now the buzzword in China. Some people say it's just a political propaganda of the state, but our survey shows that Chinese college students have a very positive attitude to this concept. It's actually quite widely accepted. The data shows that 85% Chinese students don't think that the Chinese dream is a concept of the state. And 80% don't think it is merely about the elites either. So they think that, well, it's a concept that about themselves, right? But on the other hand, we can find that majority students agree that the priority of the Chinese dream is to realize their personal dreams. It's a little bit different with the concept defined by the state. And we ask the students to evaluate their family economic situation compared to their cohorts, good, okay, or bad. And we found that students with better economic self-evaluated better family background are more likely to are less likely to accept this concept from the state, and they are less likely to accept to think that the concept is merely about the elites. But students from the better family from the worse family ground are more preference on the priority of Chinese dream as a personal dream. And let's talk about the confidence of social mobility. Well, surprisingly, we find that Chinese students are very much confident about social mobility, even though we already talk about a lot of social inequalities. We can find that, well, for the first question, that people still have plenty of opportunities to succeed in works if work hard enough. We can find that 52.9% students agree this, and 21.8% students strongly agree this. So it's very positive. And the second question is, kids from poor family still have plenty of opportunities to enroll in elite university through self-promotion, and their positive rate is still very high. But on the third question, that if people cannot succeed in tests for officials without strong connections, the opinion is split. We can find that almost half to half. And for students from the poor family background are more optimistic about general upward ability. We can find the rate from the 68% to 75%. And but students from the richer family background are more optimistic for public post test. That's a very interesting difference. And students from the rural are slightly optimistic on elite college entrance test than students from urban. That might not be a significant difference, but it's very interesting. And maybe it is because the respondents themselves, comes from, they have succeeded in their entrance examinations. That's why they think about this. And we can find a very apparent split on gender inequality, that male students don't think that females have to work harder than males to be succeeded, while the female students don't think so, totally. It's very apparent, okay. And trust in society political news sources, we have listed several items to let them to evaluate, and we found that the most trusted news sources is a statement from the central government, and then the state mainstream press, and state statement from the local government, and the foreign mainstream press, marketized at domestic price. And it's surprising for me that the news source from the internet, like the V account of the Weibo, that's Chinese Twitter, and the internet forum is much lower than those organized medias. But we cannot call the too late as a new media, because the mainstream state media also use a lot of new technology to propaganda. So, and the party members trust more on those media sources except to the internet forum. And the data here is the mean of the result. And the great firewall student who climb the great firewall more are trust more in foreign self-media and the internet. And the gender. Female students are more likely to trust those medias than male students, except on their internet forum and VIP account on the Weibo. And students from the urban are more likely to trust in foreign and marketized medias. And this is a trust in charity channels. Okay. And we can find that, well, the most trusted charity channels is friends and classmates. That's reasonable. And state organs, private organs, foreign organs, third-party payment, corporate activists, and celebrity activists. And the last one is the Red Cross. We just tested this because Red Cross was on a huge scandal. And it turns out that if you get a scandal, it takes a long time to be trusted again. But it's also a surprise for us to find that actually students are more likely to trust the charity channels with the organized Asian background instead of those with commercial backgrounds. And this conclusion, I'll go through very quickly. Chinese college students' interpretation of the Chinese dream is connected with their dreams or desires on personal realization. It's a slightly different with the state definition. And most are optimistic on upward social mobility through self-promotion, while more than half are pessimistic on competition into the public post and gender issues. So the policy implication is that if you want to promote confidence in social mobility, the government needs to create more equalities, particularly inside the state system. Conclusion two is that Chinese college students are not apolitical, though they barely or they don't have enough chances to participate into radical political activities like protests and demonstrations. More than 60% read societal political news, almost half discuss politics, 15% write comments online about politics, and 16% boycott products for political reasons. It's still surprising. And one-third participate into philanthropic activities or donate voluntarily. And elite students prefer to talk and read, while students from junior college are more likely to act. So party members might not be an effective indicator in predicting political behaviors, vice versa, other social political involvements. And most students trust more in statements of government and organized public media than in less organized self-media. A counter-movement on the internet might be emerging because, you know, probably because of the government's campaign on the scandals or rumors on the internet. And charity channels with commercial backgrounds and less trust than state and civic ones, while those with scandals need long time to recover. Internet behaviors have significant impact on trust, but socioeconomic differentiation also matters. Thank you very much.
Okay, I'd like to invite all of the panelists to join me up here on the stage for a question and answer session. So thank you very much, first of all, to all the panelists. I think it's fantastic and very interesting information that they have provided us with today. I only wish we had more time to hear some of their fascinating findings. But I think since we're running a little bit behind, I would like to sort of, rather than posing my own question, jump straight into the questions from the audience. And then perhaps if there's time remaining at the end, I'll pose a few questions myself. But can I invite the audience to open it up for questions?
Yeah, just a simple curious question about what Chinese young people are watching on American TV. A lot of the things you said was watching, you know, this group of national channel. But what specifically, what are the shows that attract young people? What are the imagery of those shows? What are the themes of those shows? If you could just give us more of an impression of what that is. I mean, that would help me as an American to understand the Chinese eyes seeing American culture. What is the attractor and what types of entertainment and shows?
Thank you for your question. 国产的电视剧其实还是有很大的发展空间，因为中国是在转型期的，我们的社会矛盾是跟其他的社会有很大的区别，就是我们比如说贫富差距导致的一些社会结构紧张也会在文艺作品中表现出来。所以中国的老百姓或者是年轻人还是会看一些基于本土经验的一些文艺作品。美国的电视剧我们理解到大学生还是会看一些跟知识有，就是跟知识分子有关的，比如说Big Bang Theory 这种电视剧，还有 当然更多的是一些娱乐性的电视剧，是一些喜剧。
Okay, so most Chinese college students or the youth in China are still watching the local productions. And I think that as far as TV programs in China is concerned, there's still space for them to grow because China is still in a transitional period of restructuring the country's system. So it is somehow kind of unique or set itself apart from the other societies. So all of these situations in China have been reflected in the entertainment business in China. As far as the U.S. TV series is concerned, she mentioned a show that I didn't quite get, but most college students tend to lean towards intellectual shows like probably documentaries or that sort of things, but also entertainment, more entertaining types of shows, for example, sitcoms as one of them.
另外一个方面是美国和韩国的文化产业现在是世界上比较成熟的，他们的技术是非常领先的，但是我们的国家现在在文化产业的市场上非常有资金，所以在学习技术和商业模式的这些方面也是在逐渐进步的。
So currently, if you look at the entertainment business or cultural business, U.S. and Korea are more advanced and they have more mature industries and also higher technology. But as far as the cultural products in China is concerned, we have the money, we have the, and so we're still learning and growing in terms of acquiring technology, and also formulating our business models.
当然不可否认的是，商业化其实在全球化的作用下已经越来越在中国表现出来。比方说在文化产业上，也出现了一些追随美国和韩国商业化、娱乐化甚至低俗化的一些倾向，因为这是非常成功的商业模式。
Because the U.S. and Korea have very successful commercialization and entertainment models, and so we have begun to see that the same things are now emerging in the Chinese productions.
Okay, a question from the lady here. And can I also ask that you please identify yourself and your affiliation when you stand up to ask your question?
My name is Beverly Hong Fincher. I just wonder if you have talk shows like Bill Moyers. I mean, are there any followers of Bill Moyers or Charlie Rose, etc.? Because you mentioned that, you know, some of the variants are voluntary. And these are, you know, how many would voluntarily watch Bill Moyers or Charlie Rose, et cetera?
Bill Moyers 和 Charlie Rose 是美国那个脱口秀非常著名的这个主持人，而且是比较倾向知识性的这种主持人。那
有多少人看这种？
哎，有多少人？
对，
在我们的这一次的调查里，我们没有加入美国的这种脱口秀的节目，也没有加入选秀的节目，这是因为问卷篇幅的限制，但是进一步的研究中我们可能会增加这部分的内容，目前只是在电视剧和流行音乐方面还有一些其他的文艺实践上。
这没，中国没有这一类的。
不是
我没有进去，没看、这个、
就是我们的这次的调查没有包含这部分
调查。 OK So, our research or studies did not include the part about how many people are watching shows like Bill Moyers and Charlie Rose. And mostly our studies are focused on just television shows and other popular shows.
Yes, Dr. Cheng Li.
Well, congratulations for it's a really very impressive panel, and also congratulate my colleague, the Kars, that you a great effort to train young scholars. You know, it's really quite impressive. And my question is for Lü Peng about the concept of Chinese dream, and certainly caught my attention. Now, as we know that the definition of Chinese dream has two major components. One is related with international affairs. It's the rejuvenation of a Chinese nation.
The other is the like middle class lifestyle and also the opportunity for poor people, low class, to enter the middle class lifestyle. How you distinguish these two in your survey? And is it possible that the people, when they answer that question, not so much in your line of thinking about the middle class, but rather China's rise? Now, and also related with this question is, have you noticed any other studies in China, survey study about Chinese dream, which may not yield the same positive results? And I haven't noticed that, but I was really quite impressed by this high, positive response. And if I may, I want to ask a final question. For your survey, you mentioned, several of you mentioned this is the first phase, right, phase one. So when will be the phase two? And what do you want to emphasize in phase two?
Okay, that's three questions. The first one is that for our survey, we actually did not give a definition of Chinese dream. We just asked the respondents several questions on Chinese dreams, but they can define Chinese dream by themselves. What kind of is Chinese in your mind, actually? So, and that indicates that Chinese students, they have very positive attitudes to the concept, but might not the exact concept as the state wants them to have. So, social mobility is a vital part of the Chinese dream, I think, but the state maybe wants to emphasize the other side. So the students might, that's why I see they have different opinions on it. And on the second question about their priorities of the survey this year, the second wave, we would like actually to dig more about those patterns of behaviors, because for the first wave we already discussed some very interesting trends. We want to design the questionnaire as a more theory driven and more deeper. And for the political attitudes part, which I designed for this year, we would like actually to design a questionnaire that less political, because we actually find that if you ask students questions about politics, they actually cannot understand it clearly sometimes. And if you do not use the way, they can understand, especially for students from junior colleges. If you talk about some big words, especially political philosophy words, they actually cannot understand it as you think they understand. So we try to know their political attitudes through their everyday life participation. That's why in the first wave of our survey, we didn't ask them about how to think about democracy or how to think about their political systems. We just ask about how do you think about charities. Because this might be a more useful way to reflect their real attitudes towards the social and the political activities. Thank you.
On the corner here and back, this woman.
Hi, I'm Wang Yi from Georgetown University. As Chinese student, I really appreciate your efforts and studies on Chinese youth. My question to all of you is, as you mentioned, the elite group in Chinese youth, they are more focused on the Western culture. They are more they are more likely to be influenced by the American culture, the soap operas, the smartphones, technology. I'm wondering, what do you think about this phenomenon in terms of the influence on Chinese future development? Thank you.
Are you saying that what kind of impact their attraction to Western cultures have the impact on the Chinese youth? 对，就是那个 对，现在中国年轻人很喜欢西方的文化，美国文化，尤其看这些娱乐节目，这些对他们呢，中国的青年人有什么样的影响，是吧？然后这个更广泛的说，就是对整个中国的这个社会发展呢，会有什么样的影响？按一下啊。
我的这个研究其实主要就是在说，我们这个时候接受的这些外来的文化，它对于青年人的成长会是，比如说这是一种多元的文化能力，这种多元的文化能力是加入到他的文化资本里的。就是说他将来在他的文化资本会影响到他的就业取向，他对未来的设计，比如说他会不会移民或者到美国来学习，这种东西是有点不为人知的，是隐藏的一个变量。就是说在社会分化的前期，文化的作用是以一种比较隐藏的方式在起作用。然后这种风格分化实际上是对现在目前的一种描述，这种描述将来可能产生社会，就比如说文化上的分层，可能是一个影响。
Okay, I want to add two more points.
这样我先翻一下。
Okay.
You know, it's okay, it's okay. So yeah, our study is actually also focused on the influence of foreign cultures or foreign influence.As the Chinese youth continue to grow, whether they are going to incorporate this kind of imported cultures into their own, and how that's going to affect them in the future when they want to choose their career path, for example, whether they want to come to the United States to study. And in our study or in sociology, we call it a hidden variant.Am I saying it right now? Oh, hidden variable. I'm not a sociologist. I think by listening to all this kind of descriptions about how they are attracted to Western culture and so forth, I think in the future a phenomenon may be that we're going to see also cultural stratification in China.
Okay, I want to add two points. The first is that putting the question of how to define the Western culture aside, it's...inaccurate to claim that Chinese students are more preferable to the Western cultures, because our data just reveals that it's just a certain part of Chinese students are more preferable to a certain kinds of American cultural products. So there is actually apparent differentiation among Chinese students. It's actually surprised me that we find that a large proportion of Chinese students, especially those from the rural and poor family backgrounds, prefer to their domestic produced products, especially those, you know, the anti-Japanese movies. It's very surprising to find that those movies have very large market. And so it reminds us that on one hand, we have a trend of Chinese young peoplePro the so-called Western cultures, but on the other hand, the populism might be another way for the Chinese young people. And the second is that for your question about the impact on the future development, in the second wave, our data, we want to design some questions on the relationship between culture preference and actions. We want to test whether a people prefer to American values are more likely to agree with American values. And just so far, we find that we don't have the large scale survey, but we have a small group of tests. We find that this connection is not very significant as we thought. So they like American dramas, but they might don't act as the way Americans do.
Okay, thank you. I think we are getting towards the end of our time here, so unfortunately I'm going to cut off the questions from the audience, but hopefully you'll have an opportunity to perhaps speak with some of these scholars afterward. Also, I would like to say that there are going to be the PowerPoints from the presentations available today. They will be online, as will be a audio transcript of the proceedings of today's conference. And I would just like to thank all of the scholars who have come here from the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences and the Brookings Institution once again for hosting this. I think that this has been an interesting entree into a dialogue about Chinese youth and the future of Chinese youth. Okay, thank you very much.